Good afternoon, everyone. I call this meeting of the Senate Education Committee to order. It is 3:33 p.m. here on Monday, March 6th. We're in the Belts Committee Room here in the state capitol of the Alaska Legislature in Juneau. I ask folks to please mute their cell phones. With us today, Senator Keel, Vice Chair President Stevens, Senator Bjorkman, and Senator L.B. Gray Jackson, and myself, Senator Tobin. Please let the quorum reflect that we have a quorum to conduct business. Thanks to Sydney and Mary Gwen once again for holding down the fort and making sure that all of our information is recorded. On the agenda today, we'll be having the second hearing for Senate Bill 29. I believe this is Senator or President Stevens' bill. It is to improve the awareness and importance of civics education in Alaska. We'll also be holding a second hearing for Senate Bill 24 to amend the existing health curriculum statutes to include mental health curriculum in all K-12 health classrooms across the state. And this is sponsored by our own Senator Gray Jackson. After that, we'll hear a detailed presentation on the foundation funding formula for public education from the Department of Education and Early Development and from Legislative Finance. So, starting off with our first item of business will be Senate Bill 29. I believe Senator Stevens' aide, Tim Lampkin, will be presenting for us. Senator Stevens, do you have some opening comments?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate your hearing this bill. The goal, of course, is to make sure that the young people of Alaska, when they leave school, become citizens. So it's about citizenship. It's about understanding what it means to be a citizen. It's about helping our young people understand that. So I'm ask Tim Lampkin to go into some details here.
Excellent. But before Mr. Lampkin starts his presentation, we do need to adopt a committee substitute. That should be included in your packet. There's also copies on the very wonderfully laid out display here of paper and items if anyone is interested in viewing those. I believe we have a motion.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move to adopt work order 33-LS0246/S as our working document for Senate Bill 29.
And I'm going to object for purposes of discussion. Mr. Lampkin, will you please present to us a summary of changes?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Tim Lampkin, staff to Senator Stevens. Before you should be Blank CS Draft S Sierra. The changes from the original version A include, for starters, that we relieved the data reporting requirements from school districts, reporting to DEED on an annual basis, as well as there in turn the DEED's requirement to report that in its annual report to the legislature. However, we did maintain that the reporting of the recommendations made by the commissions are going to be continued. Secondly, you'll find on page 3, line 18 of version S, we struck reference to the Lieutenant Governor's office staffing this commission and transferred that instead as a function of the Department of Education, with the caveat later that the Legislative Council has the option of providing assistance in the function of the duties of the commission to help alleviate some of the administrative burden for conducting those meetings. And then thirdly, I kind of combine number 2 and 4 there. But thirdly is we redesigned the representation of the judiciary on the commission. There was concern expressed that a seated Supreme Court justice sitting on such a commission discussing and making recommendations for policies regarding our civic education in the state wasn't entirely appropriate. So to maintain their impartiality and neutrality, we changed that to a retired judge. Not just a Supreme Court judge, but any retired judge, or rather a judicial officer, which really broadens the pool. And if the judge isn't available, then we change that to that an administrative director could make such an appointment. So that was a compromise to maintain the fact that it's appropriate to have equal representation or some representation from the executive, legislative, and judicial branches of government, given the context of what we're talking about here. And then as I touched upon, the fourth changes on page 4, lines 29 to 29, and through page 5, line 2, allowing Ledge Council to assist the commission in conducting its meetings and offering legislative resources for things like meeting locations, the LIOs, our streaming network, telecoms, and that sort of thing. That concludes the summary of changes, Madam Chair.
Thank you. With that, I will remove my objection. All right. Any other, without objection, work order 33-LS0246/S is adopted as our working document. Any other questions before we move on to fiscal notes? All right, let's tackle the fiscal notes. So our first fiscal note is from the Department of Education and Early Development. I believe Director Manning is online. Deputy Director Manning, are you with us?
Yes, good afternoon. I am here.
If you could please state your name and title for the record, and please review the deed fiscal note for SB 29 when you are ready.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me. Again, this is Deputy Director Kelly Manning with the Division of Innovation and Education Excellence for the Department of Education. We submitted a fiscal note that breaks down the costs for the department, and it's broken into two sections. One is a section that lays out one-time expenses, and then another section that breaks out out-year annual expenses. The first thing I will note is the one-time expenses. So we have included $49.5 for department staff and 20 educators to travel to civics curriculum and assessment development convenings. This would be to convene a stakeholder group to participate in the development of standards in alignment to the updates requested in this bill. In addition, we've included $229,000.1 to contract a facilitator to convene department staff, educators, and stakeholders for participation in the development of a civics assessment and corresponding secondary semester-long civics curriculum, as well as associated data collection elements and legal fees. This is a more substantial component because it would include both the development of the standards as well as the development of curriculum. Because that's a two-part process, it would take a little bit more time and effort and require multiple processes to go through. So first the development of the standards and then the associated curriculum. In addition, we have $5,000 for initial supplies and equipment setup of a new employee. This would be, I'll cover in the out-year annual expenses as well, but this is for setting up an employee to support the commission. And then in addition, we have $40,000 for stipends for the participants in the curriculum and standards development. So those are the one-time expenses. The out-year expenses would include $118,800 for one Education Specialist 2 position to serve as a Social Studies Content Specialist and Alaska Civics Education Commission Coordinator. This position would staff the commission as well as serve as the Social Studies Content Specialist for the department. We've included $4,000 for staff travel to an annual in-person commission convening, should that be required of the commission to have an annual convening, as well as $33,100 for annual in-person commission convening and department chargeback expenses. That would include costs for the travel as well as convening location to convene the commission on an annual basis. And that assumes a one-time annual in-person. As noted in the bill, there's the option for virtual meetings. So this would be under the assumption that there would be one annual meeting of that commission. Those are the key components that the department has identified for costs for supporting this bill.
Thank you, Deputy Director Manning. Are there any questions related to this fiscal note? Seeing
none. Madam Chair, maybe I should say that I was absolutely shocked when I saw what the department had done with this bill. If you wanted to kill a bill, this is the way to do it. It does not need a full-time employee, so we are working on fiscal notes that will substantially reduce this, taking it out of the hands of the Lieutenant Governor's office, which also had a full-time employee. This is just not necessary. Version S should reduce the fiscal note considerably.
Thank you, sir. Well, thank you, Deputy Director Manning. I believe we'll look forward to updated fiscal notes as the bill continues to move. Seeing that there's no more questions for Deputy Director Manning, we'll move on to the second fiscal note, which is from the Lieutenant Governor's office. I believe the Lieutenant Governor's Chief of Staff, Mr. Appleby, is here to present for us. Mr. Appleby, if you could please state your name and title for the record and give us an overview of your fiscal note when you are ready.
Well, good afternoon. My name is Josh Appleby. I'm Chief of Staff to Lieutenant Governor Nancy Dahlstrom. And that's the first time I've got a chance to say that on the record. That's pretty cool. Thanks for having me. The new CS adopted by the committee makes our fiscal note irrelevant, and so there's really nothing to go over. Working with Senator Stevens and his staff, we were finding a way just to zero it out entirely. So,
thank you very much, sir. Are there any questions for Mr. Appleby? I believe you're off the hook.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Well, before we move on to public testimony, are there any additional questions from committee members? Seeing none, I will open public testimony. For those who are online, please call in Anchorage 907-563-9085. For those here in Juneau who would like to testify on SB 29, the number is 907-586-9085. And for all others, you are able to go to your LIO or you may call 1-844-586-9085. You can also submit your public testimony to senate.education@akleg.gov. Again, that is senate.education@akleg.gov. I believe we have three folks here who are currently online to provide testimony. We'll move first to Fairbanks, Ellen Weiser. Ellen, if you could please identify yourself for the record and begin your testimony when you are ready.
Yes, my name is Ellen Weiser. Excuse me. I'm the president of Kids Voting North Alaska, and I'm testifying on behalf of our board. I can submit the names of the board of directors if you wish. Kids Voting North Alaska is a nonpartisan voter education program committed to helping students in Interior Alaska become lifelong learners, lifelong voters. We have been working in the schools in Fairbanks, North Star Borough for over 30 years. Kids Voting North Alaska is a great supporter of civics education in our school and appreciate all the efforts that you have engaged to support it. Our board, after some discussion, would like to share with you some thoughts about SB 29. We agree with the premise that our students would benefit from a one-semester civics course as a graduation requirement. According to the new civics, preparing students to be engaged, productive citizens is one of the foundational purposes of public education in the United States. Thomas Jefferson, John Adams, Horace Mann, to name a few, all espoused free, universal public education as the key element that was necessary to maintain the integrity of the American Republic over time. Public schools remain as the best avenue to ensure that citizens possess the knowledge, skills, and disposition needed for productive participation in civic and political life. You know, this week has been declared National Civics Week, so what better time to hear this bill? We also hope, as outlined in the 2020 report from Educating for American Democracy, that schools should integrate the teaching of history and civics into a complementary curriculum. That means really that the high school level, civics should not take the form of a one semester and done requirement. States and districts should shift from breadth to depth. Many state civics requirements read as a long list of facts and principles to be memorized. Using this type of curriculum, a test based on the naturalization exam would be easy to administer, but a measurement of the wrong principles of civics. States should reconceive educational goals in terms of open-ended questions to stimulate analytical thinking. We have concerns about the exit exam as civics as modeled on the civic portion of the citizenship test as a graduation requirement. Graduation exams have been tried before in Alaska and established powerful obstacles to graduation. Civics education is more than memorizing facts about our government. It is putting that knowledge to use by looking at our town, borough, state, and nation and working to make positive, informative changes. We would highly encourage civics courses that have a service learning component as a culminating activity. In addition, civics education should look to the local as well as the state and the national government, especially in non-presidential years, And that would look very different across this state, which would be another reason to oppose a statewide, fact-based exit exam sort of test. A major component of the civics class must be evaluation of new sources as factuality versus unsupported opinion. Thus, instructors would be most effective at assessing their students' mastery of the class's content. The bill should direct the assessment to be flexible and built on local control to be personalized to local communities. It should be more of a portfolio of options rather than a one-and-done test. Additionally, any mandate assessment tied to graduation must be accompanied by enlarging the number of highly qualified civics teachers employed in our district, as well as robust professional development and support for districts across the state. The legislature must not give a mandated assessment without providing support to schools to make students successful. This is a recipe for disaster and the very definition of unfunded mandates. We do not agree with the need for a civics commission. We understand the importance of multiple voices when building the standards for this new course, but it is equally, if not more, important that the standards are set by people who have the time to devote to the task properly. SB 29 should designate Alaskan educators to be the experts to create the curriculum and assessment. Alaska civic educators are experts in our field and know Alaska students.
Ms. Weiser, if you could please wrap up your comments.
Pardon me?
If you could please wrap up your comments.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay. Just one more thing. While the state of Alaska sets content standards for government and citizenship, it is not in the practice of mandating a statewide curriculum for any subject. The choice of curriculum has always been historically left up to the local education agencies in Alaska to determine for themselves. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We'll stay in Fairbanks. We have Tim Dorian on the line. Tim, if you could please identify yourself for the record and begin your testimony when you are ready. I apologize earlier. The time limit is 5 minutes.
Sure, not a problem. This is Tim Dorian, D-O-R-A-N. In Fairbanks. I'm a 40-year-plus educator and continue to stay involved as I'm going along. And so I would like to share a perspective on civics in our public schools. Every teacher and educator in the building teaches civics. Indeed, schools, especially public schools, are prime examples of civics in action. From the moment a child steps into the setting, they are learning how to get along, how to work together, how to share, and to respect others. They are both building a community and learning to live within a community as well as how our broader community operates. Is this not the essence of being a citizen and a student of civics? On a curricular basis, in Fairbanks, and similarly in other Alaskan school districts, students learn textual civics every year. Kindergarten, Me and My World. First grade, My Place in My World. Second, My Local Community. Third grade, Alaska, Past, Present, and Future. Fourth grade, U.S. Physical and Cultural Geography. Fifth grade, Foundations of U.S. Government and Civic Engagement. Sixth, Ancient Civilizations. Seventh, World Studies. Eighth, Early U.S. History. In high school, students are required to take courses across five civics-related areas: Alaska Studies, Half a Credit, World Studies, Full Credit, U.S. Studies, a Full Credit, Government Studies, Half a Credit, and Economic Studies, Half a Credit. Importantly, students also learn the contextual skills of reading, writing, speaking, research, analyzing, discerning, civil discourse, discovery, reflection, and more across the disciplines. In essence, students are immersed in civics training and get to have hands-on experience in a civil community. They live civics. SB 29 is based on, I would say, a false but at least a weak premise, and would establish a third-party entity to establish a civics curriculum, endangering local control over education. and it establishes a high-stakes test for high school graduation. Both these steps should be cautionary. Might the civics panel promote a special brand of civics, which might be less broad and inclusive as that found in our public schools today, guided by our state standards? And should a student be refused graduation based on a single test score? We previously did this with the high school qualifying exam, which was later removed because of its inequitable impact on students. My professional vision is that every student will become a competent, confident, curious, caring, and contributing citizen. I strive for this every day, and I am reinforced in this vision as I watch students and educators implement the learning and teaching process. I see this on a regular basis in our school. I am not in favor of SB 29. I would urge you to, more importantly, support, encourage, and recognize what teachers do every single day in teaching civics in our schools with our students. So thank you for your time today and all the thoughts that you're putting into this.
Thank you, Mr. Dorian, for your public testimony. We are going to stay in Fairbanks. Now we have Amy Galway. Amy, if you could please identify yourself for the record and begin your testimony when you are ready. You have 5 minutes.
Hello, my name is Amy Galloway. I'm a high school civics teacher in Fairbanks, Alaska, and I'm calling in representing myself, and I am also the 2020 Alaska Teacher of the Year. While I support the concept of Senate Bill 29, I do not support the bill in its current iteration. It is not evidence-based, and while it addresses the right issue, it is supplying the wrong solution. SB 29 should be changed to direct deed and the State Board of Education in concert with practicing educators to develop relevant, engaging, and evidence-based K-12 civic standards based on the 2020 Educating for American Democracy Roadmap. Accompanying the standards, these can include a portfolio of authentic assessment options to fulfill a locally created civic engagement assessment. This will make for a much more rigorous curriculum, as well as one that is supported by research so that Alaska's students are fully prepared to save the future of our republic. For the last 24 years, I have told my students that representative democracy is a living organism. It is a process of becoming, not a destination. It requires the knowledge, skills, and dispositions of civic life to be systematically taught and assessed K-12. So, to say that I am grateful to legislators for seeing the importance of civic education and for creating this bill is undeniable. Thank you for elevating the need for engaged and informed citizens. So while I said I believe this is the right issue to be addressing in our communities where apathy is rampant, I do believe it is the wrong solution, but not out of malice, out of a misunderstanding of the problem itself. I think many non-educators may perceive that this is simply a problem of knowledge, that people don't know because they haven't been taught. And if we teach them, then they'll just know and be good citizens. But civics education is not and never will be about simply knowing the facts. At its core, it's about reading the word and reading about how the world works. People aren't disengaged because their level of civic knowledge is low. They're disengaged because their political efficacy is low. They don't have the skills to be effective citizens, nor do they have the experience of successful participation. So while I don't have all the answers, my experience in education has taught me a few suggestions. We need to declutter social studies curriculum by reducing core content to make room for problem-solving, critical thinking, and actually applying skills like doing projects like Kids Voting, History Day, and We the People. Assessment and instruction are inextricably linked. So if we make the citizenship test a high-stakes assessment tied to a diploma, it will be a race to a bottom where students know some things they memorize and forget. I can tell you that I teach the citizenship test in my class, and I make every student take it. It's a valuable tool. It is not the be-all and end-all and should not be a high-stakes assessment. Finally, I would argue our state really needs to provide more training and support for educators. So if a bill like this passes that really amplifies and elevates civic education like it should, please provide training year in and year out from qualified civic educators to help teachers teach this subject. Finally, while I think the idea of a commission is interesting, it doesn't seem necessary. I would argue that DEED already has a process for creating and writing curriculum, and that we should leave curriculum writing to teachers and experts who are in the field and not engage it in a process that might become more partisan like this commission. Ultimately, I want to say thank you for elevating civic education. I'm so excited that it's in the crosshairs of the legislature, and I am hopeful for the state of our state and the state of our union, because civics education is really having its moment. And I do know that as I work with my students and do authentic assessments, it is not the citizenship test they remember when they leave. It is the authentic, engaged, community-based assessments, things like writing you legislators. It is that they remember and carry with them as voters. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Galloway. Right on time. Seeing that there is no one else online, is there anyone here in the room that wishes to testify? Seeing none, I'll close public testimony. Any questions before we move on? All right. I would like to pass this bill out of committee today, but I look to the will of the committee.
Could I make a comment first?
Yes, President Stevens.
You know, it's hard to get the perfect bill, and it's hard to fund things that we need to do in this state, but I appreciate what the people from Fairbanks had to say. But if we were doing such a good job, young people would understand what it means to be a citizen, and we're not. Statewide, we're doing a very poor job in helping our children learning how to vote, learning how to be a citizen. And the comments, you know, I realize we've had some rumor back earlier when we first read this bill. There are so many positive things we heard from the experts about it. Don't forget that. And I'd hope you can accept what these folks have said and try to make this bill better as it goes on to the next committee. But I do think it's important that young people be encouraged to become citizens. You know, actually, the one speaker saying that this is a foundational reason why we became a country, to create citizens so they would be participate and vote. So anyway, I still think it's a good bill. I appreciate your support.
Senator Keel.
Madam Chair, thank you, Madam Chair. I very much appreciate the work that the sponsor has done on this bill, and certainly it is a more perfect bill than the version that came to the Senate floor last year. It is not a high-stakes test. The test is one of the ways a student can demonstrate their mastery of the material. and so I am happy to support it. You can always get locked into the quest for utter perfection. But this, I think, is a step forward. Madam Chair, if you're ready for a motion, I'd be happy, or did you have someone else queued up? Thank you.
Senator Jackson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to say that I support this bill, and I appreciate all the comments from folks in Fairbanks, but I really support this bill. I supported it during the last session, and I appreciate the fact that President Stevens was able to make changes in the meeting section of the bill that provides for the legislative council to assist in meetings. So thank you for that change, President Stevens, and I'm happy to move forward. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. I will entertain a motion.
Madam Chair, I move the committee report CS for Senate Bill 29 Work Order 33LS0246/S, as in Skagway, from committee with individual recommendations and forthcoming fiscal notes.
If there is no objection, Senate Bill 29, Work Order 33LS0246/S is reported from Senate Education Committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes. We'll be taking a brief at ease while the paperwork comes around and setting up for our next presentation. We are back on the record here in Senate Education. Our next item of business is Senate Bill 24. We had the first hearing for this bill on February 22nd. This is the second hearing for this piece of legislation. Senator Gray Jackson and her Chief of Staff, Bessie Odom, are here. Would you like to provide some opening comments?
Thank you, Madam Chair, Senator Gray Jackson. And I just appreciate the committee hearing the bill for a second time. The bill simply encourages that mental health education be added to a whole list of other subject matters that are already in state statute. And it also provides several different agencies who are going to develop the curriculum for this mental health education. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Gray Jackson. Seeing no additional questions, we're going to move on to fiscal notes. I believe Deputy Director Manning is on the line and will be providing us an overview of the deed fiscal note attached to this piece of legislation.
Good afternoon. For the record, this is Kelly Manning, Deputy Director for the Division of Innovation and Education Excellence. I'm getting a lot of feedback. Are you hearing me okay?
We are hearing you okay.
Okay, great. As mentioned, I'm here to review the fiscal note from the department. I will call attention to the one-time expenses for updating the standards. So the fiscal note includes the following one-time expenses. We have $120,000 for 30 committee members to travel twice in a year for in-person convenings. That would be a $2,000 per participant. And that is to convene committee members, stakeholders from around the state with pertinent insight into the standards to help us develop the standards to meet this requirement. In addition, we would need $36,000, and that would include $30,000 to hire a facilitator to oversee implementation and professional development for educators, as well as $6,000 for legal fees to implement the necessary regulation changes. In addition, we would require $60,000 for committee member stipends at $2,000 per participant, and that's to encourage participation in the process, as it does take quite a bit of time to participate in these types of standards updates. Those are the key costs that we have identified in association with updating the standards. Please let me know if you have any questions.
Thank you, Deputy Director Manning. Are there any questions from committee members? Seeing none, I thank you very much for your time here today.
Thank you.
Seeing no other additional comments, we're going to move on to public testimony. I now open public testimony for SB 24. If you are in Anchorage, you can call 907-563-9085. Here in Juneau, please call 907-586-9085. And if you're in other locales around the state, the phone number is 1-844-586-9085, and that is a toll-free number. You can also submit public comments to senate.education@akleg.gov. Again, that's senate.education@akleg.gov. I see on the line we have our first testifier, Stephen Pierce. Stephen, if you could please identify yourself for the record and begin your testimony when you are ready. You have 5 minutes.
Hello, my name is Stephen Pierce. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Stephen Pierce. I'm the director of the Citizens Commission on Human Rights, covering Alaska, Montana, and Washington. And as the current stands, I'd urge you to vote no on SB 24, but I think the bill can be amended to make it so it would actually be beneficial to the citizens of Alaska. Currently, we feel the bill is more directly aimed at creating a wish list for the psychiatric lobby, and it should be switched over to creating one more meaningful and effective education that will lead to the next generation of Alaskans towards health and wellness. We have been told for decades that the chemical imbalance in the brain is what drives mental illness. And recently, this last July, this was severely called into question. And in fact, the study found recently no convincing evidence that depression is caused by serotonin abnormalities, particularly by lower levels or reduced activity of serotonin. And another quote of this is, many people take antidepressants because they have been led to believe their depression has a biochemical cause, but this new research suggests this is not grounded in evidence. You know, this is actually earth-shaking, and the psychiatric lobby has not come to grips with this yet. That there is severe criticism of psychiatry because they don't admit that this is a problem. So why do people quit taking drugs? Well, they quit taking drugs because another study shows they owing to inefficacy or intolerable side effects. So there are reasons why we're having trouble with the mental health treatment that exists is because it's not achieving the goals that people want for it. So it's very clear now that the main argument justifying the psychiatric drugging of youth and adults and the elderly is marketing. It's not science. It makes the slogan, no health without mental health, a marketing slogan to push the system of creating more patients for the psychiatric system. Now, this may sound cynical and overtly like, oh, well, I'm against mental health, but what I'm really pushing for here is we have a mistake. The education is critical because what are we training our students into? So we have a mistaken view of what psychiatric drugs are doing. This is a quote. The idea that they work by targeting the underlying biological mechanisms that produce symptoms of mental disorders is actually not supported by evidence for any type of mental disorder, whether it's depression or schizophrenia or whatever. And there's a lot of material to back this up. I would urge you to, you know, take a look at it and the references, and I can provide more upon request. So we should ask this question. Why do people stop taking their drugs? Okay, we covered that. It's due to inefficacy and intolerable side effects. So with the invalidation of this main theory alone, we see how arbitrary the diagnosis is. So are we going to continue supporting the idea that these mental health labels equals these behaviors equals disease and treating with psychiatric drugs? Or are we going to turn to a more holistic natural approach, which has already been alluded to in various materials? But here's this quote. Psychiatry, unlike other fields of medicine, is based on a highly subjective diagnostic system. Essentially, you sit in the office with a physician and you are labeled based on the doctor's opinion of the symptoms you describe. There are no tests. You can't be analyzed for a substance that definitively indicates that you have depression, much in the same way a blood test can tell you that you have diabetes or anemic. That's from Dr. Kelly Grogan. So our point is that, you know, are we going to tell our kids that the only way to manage their symptoms is to be taking drugs or be diagnosed with these stigmatizing labels? And we get in the area of what's really causing the stigma. So if there's no objective means to diagnose what's going on with anybody given a psychiatric label, and we're treating them with psychiatric drugs which are chemically managing the person's behavior, or youth or elderly, then, you know, what you're creating and forwarding is a system that devalues the individual and their ability and the ability to control what's going on with them. So, and this is also covered by doctors who make a living dealing with the failures of psychiatry. So if you're being told you have to take, you know, manage your symptoms by taking medications, what if you actually could eliminate the diagnosis by simply addressing the nutrient deficiencies or correcting the physiologic imbalances by doing blood tests, by doing medical testing to screen individuals
anybody who's entering the mental health system for known physical ailments, nutritional deficiencies, allergic reactions, toxic levels of metals. There's hundreds and hundreds of these things that actually need to be tested for. And is one of the main criticisms of psychiatry is that they're not looking for the physical causes. If you believe that somebody who is...
Mr. Pierce, if you could please wrap up your comments.
Yeah. All right. Thank you. So it comes down to how much are we willing to believe to trust a system that puts a label that you can't verify on individuals. So we provided materials on this, and we urge your review of those materials, and we're available for further questions on this. We support a solution for all of the citizens, not just for the mental health lobby that really wants their wish list put forward. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Pierce. I see no questions here from the committee, so we will move on to Juno, Madison Truitt. Madison, if you could please identify yourself for the record and begin your testimony when you are ready. You have 5 minutes.
Hello, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Madison Truitt. I'm a behavioral health aide working in Juneau currently. I am CAM, a mental health first aid trained and assist certified. But today I'm calling in and I'm representing myself independently as a graduate of the University of Washington Psychology Department with a minor in law focusing in disability justice and Indigenous studies. If you could take a moment, I would like for you to imagine with me a river. And this is a river full of twists and turns. It's flowing quickly, and at some points, the currents are really deadly. As we gaze into the water, we keep seeing people crying out for help. So you and I run forward and work together to pull these people out, but we're really trying not to fall in ourselves. And that is the current state of the mental health care system, not just within our state, but across the country. We're all urgently trying to pull people out of this river of suicide, this river of crisis, depression, and grief. And we're wondering why people keep showing up in this river and why do they keep falling in. Teaching mental health at a young age is the first step into true preventative measures. This increase of awareness of emotions, feelings, how to appropriately express themselves is essential to preventing our communities and children from falling into this river. Mental health education is one of the most important foundations to long-term and holistic well-being. Holistic, that is, you know, mind, body, spirit, every aspect of it. But understanding what your body is telling you, what your feelings are saying, that's key to having that holistic health. It's in our youth that we learn how to cope. It's where we form our different attachment styles from seeing the adults around us interact with one another. And often it's this witnessing that leads to a variety of struggles that we see today, such as alcoholism, addiction, depression, anxiety, suicide, which we have a very, very, very high rate of in this state. Domestic and interpersonal violence, as well as neglect of children, is what we witness. And we are then learning that that's okay, as well as abuse. And on a personal note, missing and murdered Indigenous peoples is also a side effect of stigmatizing mental health. So these self-destructive behaviors we've learned as children from the adults that are present or not present in our lives truly are foundational into our future and where we end up. And often these opportunities are ones that are given to affluent people. The ability to have education, to see a therapist as a child, usually isn't given to those that are in need of it the most. So when we have open dialogues and normalize mental health and discussions around mental health, we reduce the stigma around mental health. And when I read this bill, I read it and I smile because it really feels hopeful. And I think like many things, there's areas of improvement of how do you do this, why do you do this. But when I read this and I see that you can consult, you know, tribal health organizations and other avenues, the ability for our own people to take care of each other is there. And in a day and age where that's put in jeopardy a lot of the time, that's pretty powerful. As a child who grew up in the state of Alaska and didn't really get to have mental health as a conversation until I was grieving the loss of my partner who passed away when I was 20, that was pretty, I could have dealt with that a lot better had I known better or had I had opportunities to. And so every child every person deserves the opportunity to understand, what am I feeling? Why am I feeling it? How do I cope with this? And it's through different coping skills that we can implement at age-appropriate levels that that's taught. A lot of my work is with youth. I do a lot of skills teaching with youth of saying, oh my gosh, that must be so frustrating, and talking with them as equals through mental health. And the empowerment that they receive and the knowledge they receive and the growth they receive from knowing their own bodies and minds is just astronomical. I think it would make a lot of us cry to see that. So I encourage you to pass this bill. Mental health is one thing that should not be kept or saved for those that can afford it. It should be something that's accessible to all. So having it in our public schools and in our curriculum is extremely important. And that is the step to changing a lot of our future. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Truitt. Seeing as there's no one else online, is there anyone here in the room that would like to testify? Seeing no one else, I'm going to close public testimony and look to the will of the committee.
So, Madam Chair, I move to report Senate Bill 24, Work Order 33-LS0232-A from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note.
If there is no objection, Senate Bill 24, Work Order 33-LS0232-A is reported from the Senate Education Committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes. We'll take a brief at ease to sign the paperwork and set up for the next presentation. Back on the record here in Senate Education, we are going to have a bit of an agenda amendment. We will only be hearing from the Department of Education and Early Development on the foundation formula today, and we will have our second presenter return to us on Friday. So Legislative Finance will be back on Friday to also present on the history of foundation, the funding formula for public education in Alaska. So with that, I'd like to ask, oh goodness, I believe there's a new title for Acting Director, Acting Deed Commissioner Heidi Teschner, and School Finance Manager Elwin Blackwell to the table. If you could please identify yourself for the record and begin your presentation when you are ready. For those who would like a copy of the presentation, there is a smorgasbord of paperwork available. Please take one.
Good afternoon. For the record, Heidi Teschner, Acting Commissioner, Department of Education and Early Development, and Elwin Blackwell, School Finance Manager, is with me this afternoon. And we do have a very long presentation. We will not go through every page of this because we hopefully know how to do math. So we will brush over the math slides, but address the points of the formula, but they're there for your reference. And we also provided a 7-page overview document that really helps truncate the presentation, but into a more easy to follow format for your viewing pleasure. But to get started, just our mission, vision, and purpose. Won't go over this. You guys know our mission, vision, and purpose at this point. But just to start with the formula. So the current public school funding formula was adopted under Senate Bill 36 in 1998 and implemented in 1999. And it's currently set out in Alaska Statute 14.17. This afternoon, we're just going to provide an overview, cover the October count and the average daily membership, how we calculate the adjusted average daily membership, the calculation for basic need, funding components for basic need, basically who pays for it, and then the additional above basic need. And I'm going to pass the presentation over to Mr. Blackwell.
Yes, and for the record, this is Elwin Blackwell, School Finance Manager. So on this, we have average daily membership. That's the starting point for our foundation formula. Average daily membership is derived through a 20-day school day count period. It counts the enrolled students during that 20-day count. The 20-day count by statute ends on the fourth Friday in October. So we always count back 20 school days from the fourth Friday in October to figure out our start point. So it does move around from year to year. Reports are due to the department 2 weeks after the end of the 20 school day count period. We also, during the same time period, we request that projections be made available to the department for the next school year. So those projections are due by statute by November 5th of each year. And
Mr. Blackwell?
Yes.
May I ask, there has been some questions about why we don't count every single day and then have an accurate daily count that is then provided to the department. Why do we do a 20-day count, or what was the rationale behind the 20-day count?
The 20-day count, the reason they do a 20-day count is it gives us a chance then to be able to clean up those numbers, and it gives us a chance to go through a process of cleaning up the numbers, giving districts a chance to verify that those numbers, if we have duplicate counts, it gives us a chance to get those records straight so that a student is only counted as a full-time equivalency for the count for the purposes of funding. And that process takes several months, actually. And so that is one aspect that we have a 20-day count. I've heard this before about why don't we count every kid and then just do it for an entire year. One of the downsides to that would be that we would always be funding off of a prior count and not a current count in that case. Those counts would always be lagging by a year at that point. So this way we can actually get a snapshot in time of what those students are within the state during this particular school year.
Thank you. Please continue.
Who qualifies as a student? This one is... We're just going to go over who is going to qualify. A child who is 6 years of age on or before September 1st and under the age of 20 has not completed the 12th grade. They can be counted in this 20-day count. A child who is 5 years of age on or before September 1st may enter kindergarten and be counted under the kindergarten count. A child with a disability and an active individualized education plan, an IEP, may attend school at the age of 3. Or if under the age of 22, if that happens by July 1st. So we can include those if they have an IEP, special ed students. At this point, this is just a slide. This is the process we're going to go through to calculate the entitlement, basic need in this particular case. And so the next several slides, we're just going to go through these elements. On step one, we're going to adjust the 20-day student count, and we're going to adjust it for school size. First off, I'd like to just make a quick note that we also will break these down by community as to how we're going to count these school sizes. So if we have a community with an ADM of under 10, then what we're going to do is we're going to take the students in that school and we're going to add them to the next smallest school in the district with an ADM greater than 10. For calculation purposes. If we have a community that falls between 10 and 10 ADM, then we are going to run grades K-12 is combined, regardless of the number of facilities. We're going to combine the K-12 grouping of ADM, and they're going to run through the school size adjustment just once. If you're 101 through 425, then we... Once again, irregardless of the number of communities you have or schools you have in your community, we will run the K-6 portion through as a school size adjustment and the 7-12 cohort through as a school size adjustment. So you get two school size adjustments in that case. If you're greater than 425, then each facility within the community that is operated as a separate school is going to get their own adjustment. I think we're going to cover one of the other exceptions to this, and that will have to do with if I only have one school in my community and I'm over 425, you're still going to get the two adjustments, the K-6 and the 7-12 adjustment. And that just came into the formula a couple of years, 2-3 years ago.
President Stevens.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Blackwell. Maybe just help me. I have no schools over that size, but I have several village schools, just around 10. So tell me how that works. So when a school is under 10, the school is closed, right? I mean, there's no funding. Do I understand that right? But yet it looks like it adds to another school, to the smallest school. Maybe help me understand that.
Through the chair, President Stevens. What that does is it creates kind of a minimum size that your school has to be. So if your school drops below 10, then we'll add it to the next smallest school in the district. The department doesn't actually close the school. That is a district determination as to whether or not to keep that school open or to close it. There is kind of a logical reason why you would want to close it, because now I'm not getting that school size adjustment, that bump up for actually administering that school in the district. But that way it sets kind of a starting point that we're going to start to move through on this school size. And that was a number that was derived back in 1998 as kind of a starting point.
Thank you.
And I probably should take just a moment to kind of go through the school size table a little bit. The school size table is a cumulative process. So each step moves the accumulated school size adjustment to the next reference line. So for each additional student that you get over these breakpoints, they get a slightly smaller factor applied to them. Until you get over 75, and then everything over 750, gets a factor of 0.84. And then that's the last factor we have. So at this point, I will move on. We do have a few exceptions in here. One is alternative schools. So in this case, if I have an alternative school with an ADM of 75 or greater and administers a separate facility, that alternative school will go through the formula as its own school. So it'll get a school size adjustment. If it is the first year of service with an ADM between 120 and 175, we're going to give it a flat adjustment of 1.33. Or it had an ADM of greater than 175 in the prior year, but drops below 175 in the current fiscal year, we're going to apply that flat factor of 1.33 again. Or if it has an ADM of less than 175, it will be counted as a part of the school in the district with the highest ADM in this case. Okay, the other exception we have is with charter schools. So with a charter school with an ADM of 150 or greater, it's going to be adjusted as a separate facility unless it is in the first year of service with an ADM between 75 and 150. It receives a flat adjustment of 1.45, or it has an ADM of 75 or greater in the prior year, but drops below this in the current year, it will receive an adjustment of 1.45. If it continues to stay below 75 ADM, then we're going to adjust and provide it a factor of 1.18. So charter schools will always receive some level of adjustment. What we are providing here is an example of Nome Public Schools projected ADMs for FY 2024. This just lines out what each school in the community was projected to have for an ADM. In this slide, we're taking those same ADMs that we had counted or had provided to us for a projection on the previous slide, and we're running them through the school size table. So this just gives you a visual of how that works in the school size table. We also have a hold harmless provision within the foundation formula. The hold harmless provision was enacted in 2008 under House Bill 273. This hold harmless provision is based on a drop in school size adjusted ADM at the district level. So in this case, if a district has a decrease in their school size, cumulative school size adjusted ADM of 5% or more in a given year, they can trigger hold harmless. And the way the hold harmless works is we create the prior year as a base year, the year of drop is compared to the base year. And then we take the difference between the base and the current year, and 75% of that difference is added back into the current year, and we carry it forward. If they continue to be below the base year, the school size adjusted is below the base year, then we will continue to do that same process, comparing the base year to the current year, taking the difference between it, and then in the second year, half of that. In the third year, if they're still below it, we'll take the difference and take a quarter of it. In this case, this slide just shows you what we would do in a calculation for known public schools to determine whether they qualified for hold harmless or not. In this case, they do not. District cost factors. We have a series of district cost factors in the foundation formula. They were last updated in 2005. They were also put into place in Alaska statute and phased in from the years FY 2009 through FY 2013. The Anchorage is the base within the district cost factors. The highest district cost factor we have currently in here is Yukon Flats at a 2.116. In this case, what we're showing you is the math for Nome, taking their school size adjusted ADM and then running it through the district cost factor at this point.
Mr. Blackwell, I know the last time that the basin allocation was evaluated in 2015, there was some conjecture around district cost factor needing to be reevaluated. Is there not a provision in statute that allows for that, or is that something that has to be directed by the legislature?
Madam Chair, for the record, Heidi Teschner, there is a statute that says the department is to review the district cost factors every couple years. We did do that a number of years ago. I don't remember when it was, and those cost factors were rejected by the legislature. And so right now it basically is an unfunded statute, and they are, as you noted, they are outdated. These, if I want to say, are really based on early 2000 numbers. So by the time that they were implemented, they were already a number of years outdated. So
as a follow-up, there is an ability for the legislature to direct DEED to do another evaluation, but they would need to accept whatever proposal DEED gave to the legislature.
Madam Chair, yes. I mean, yes, you can direct the department to do that. We would need funding as well to support that effort. Yes.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
President Stevens.
Could you tell us, what is the result of that lack of changing, of reevaluating? What is the result? Who's harmed? Who's helped by that?
I'm not sure if I have. Can you give me your question again?
Well, I'm concerned that we have not reevaluated it. We waited. And so I assume the district cost factors may have changed substantially. We have not paid attention to that, because the legislature hasn't done it. So I guess my question is, who does that really harm? Is it the very rural districts, the very small communities? Is it the native communities? Who's harmed most because we have not changed the district cost factors?
Through the chair, President Stevens, I don't know if I have an exact answer for that, but I would say it's probably, I mean, every district is going to be affected. Right now we're seeing that Anchorage may not be the base anymore. It might be the Matsu Valley. I don't know that for a fact. Those are just conversations that have been had. And so really, without reevaluating what the district cost factors will be statewide, I can't really say, you know, it's more rural versus urban. It's going to be, I think, a shift for everybody.
I understand that. Thank you. But that's an interesting thought, that Matsu may be the base. Thank you.
Special needs factor. The foundation formula provides a factor, an increase in the adjusted ADM that we are now carrying through the formula in order to provide additional funding for special needs services. In this case, the special education would include vocational education type money or activities, gifted and talented, and bilingual bicultural. And this is just provided a block funding of 20% or a 1.20 within the foundation calculation.
Senator Keel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Blackwell, Commissioner Teschner, do you have a sense from district's budgets of how that 20% relates to what they actually spend on these services?
Through the chair, Senator Keel, based on how, so as you, we'll go through the formula, and basically when we get to state aid, it becomes discretionary money to school districts. They know that this factor is in here, and so there are districts that make an effort to put the 20% towards special needs funding, but there are others who might not. So, but how we receive that, the information from districts, we don't, it doesn't disaggregate what's spent on the special needs factor or what's spent on the vocational technical factor, which we'll get to shortly. So we don't know at the state level how districts are spending this particular factor in the formula.
Just a follow-up. That includes the annual district budget audits that the department gets. You don't have a sense from those of how much is special ed funding?
Through the chair, Senator Keel. So we do know we have two functions of special education, two special education functions. So we know how much districts put towards special education, but it may or may not be directly related to this factor because it could include their special education intensives, which is on top of this particular factor. Does that help?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess I question the adequacy of a 20% block grant, which is not a department decision, it's a statute. I'm not suggesting, but I would be curious to talk with perhaps districts, if not the department, about whether when you put special ed, voc ed, gifted, and ESL kids together, whether that can possibly be done for 20%.
With a follow-up to Senator Keel's question, I'm curious about ELL or ESL. Is that included in this district cost factor as well? Or excuse me, in the special needs funding? As I see, it says bilingual, bicultural, but what about those students who may not have fluency in any language?
Madam Chair, I don't know the exact answer. I would maybe, but I would have to, I don't know that answer.
Thank you.
Just one more question.
And then Stevens.
The individual study you do of every student who had, I know in, say, special education, what is that called again? You do a report, or you do a formula on, not a formula, no. For every student who, say, is in special education, you have a study that, what is it called, individual?
Through the chair, the individual education plan, the IEP.
IEP. Now, is that just done for special education, is it done for others, like vocational, gifted, talent, bilingual? Is it only for special education students?
Through the chair, I believe it's just special education students, to my knowledge.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, back to our slides. This particular slide is taking NOMS numbers and just applying that factor to it. So it's just a mathematical slide at this point. On here, we also have a vocational technical funding factor in here. So a career and technical education is funded at a factor of 1.015. It is intended to assist districts in providing career and technical education services in grades 7 through 12. And it is not necessarily intended to cover the costs associated with administrative expenses and instruction in general literacy, mathematics, and job readiness skills.
May I ask what I think might be an obvious question for myself, but I'm curious. So in special needs funding, you have vocational education, and here you have a cost factor for vocational technical funding. What am I missing?
Chair Tobin, the when this was originally done, the 20%, Alaska under the old foundation formula had some categorical funding, so we identified students that were special needs, bilingual, vocational, technical, these different aspects of it. And so when this new formula was developed and they created this general multiplier to kind of cover those activities that we used to identify. It did include that. At a later date, we ended up getting the CTE factor added in. So there is, within these slides, it looks like there's a tiny bit of double dipping on this.
I appreciate that clarification. And similar to Senator Keel's question, is this then also delineated when districts do an audit of their resources for the department? Do we see this specifically called out, the CTE?
Chair Tobin, it is not specifically called out. We do not have specific function codes that would identify CTE type instruction.
Thank you.
This is also another math slide showing the application of the CTE factor. We also have a provision that was added just a few years back for consolidation of schools. One of the issues that we ran into with our hold harmless provision is large districts could see decreases in student populations, but they would never be significant enough to trigger the hold harmless provision. In this case, we have a consolidated schools. So as a district sees a decrease in student population and they have an opportunity then to maybe reshuffle that student population and be able to surplus a school or two, be able to move those students out of that one school into two or three, maybe one or two, three other schools. This is an opportunity for them to be able to do that and somewhat be held harmless for the next several years as they move through downsizing their facilities. In this case, they are kind of held harmless. They get 100% of that offset, the difference between consolidation and pre-consolidation. They get 100% of that. We factor it out and we figure it out and then add it back into their adjusted ADM. For the first 2 years, and then we step them down a third each year out to the fourth year. By the fifth year, they're now down to what will be considered their base for going forward. We have no more level of adjustment. We have put in some sideboards onto this in a way so that a district can't consolidate schools, get to the end of the process, decide to open up the school, get that school size adjustment in the future, and then turn around in a year or two, consolidate again, so they can't just keep moving back and forth. If they do this, we run through the process. The school has to be off the books for at least 7 years, unless if they have explosive growth, they could always come back to us and show that they've had explosive growth and they need to get that school back open. But other than that, typically we would keep it off the books for that length of time.
President Stevens.
Thank you. I guess that begs the question, has this worked? Have we, in fact, consolidated the schools in Alaska?
Through the chair, President Stevens, yes, we have run through the process of consolidating schools. We've done it. We did it in Anchorage, or Anchorage has done it, I should say, and Kenai has done it. We have not run through the full process because we started this process with the districts, and then we had COVID. And COVID completely upended the way the theory behind the formula got upended. We'll put it that way. We used to say that a large district probably would never trigger hold harmless, but since hold harmless is based off of school size adjustment, when we saw a mass out-migration out of the brick and mortar schools into correspondence in fiscal year 2021, we did find that districts such as Anchorage and Fairbanks and these other districts triggered hold harmless, the regular school size hold harmless at that point. And so we went to them and said, which do you want? Do you want your school size hold harmless or do you want consolidated schools? You can't have them both. And it was fiscally advantageous to them to take the school size hold harmless. So we never quite got all the way through this process, but we have experience or had a couple of districts consolidate schools at this point.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, step five, intensive services funding. We had been talking about our special education students at our, this block grant that we had at 1.20. Though the intensive needs students are part of the general population, we also take an opportunity to identify each intensive needs students. Now, these are students that have met a specific criteria to be classified as intensive needs, and they usually require a significant amount of additional resources to be able to provide the education listed in their IEP. And at this point, what we will do is on the last day of the count period, the district will identify each one of those students that meets the qualifications for an intensive needs student. They will then report that to us. At this point, what we'll do is we'll take that number and we will multiply it by a factor of 13. And at that point, we will then add that that intensive needs count multiplied up by 13 back into the adjusted school size. Average daily membership. I'm getting tripped up, but that's the way it works.
I do have an additional question. Is there additional reporting with this funding particularly? Is there, I know students need IEPs. Is there other types of required services to receive this funding or to have to account for this funding?
Madam Chair, there is a specific requirements for this funding, and I'm drawing a blank on everything that's on there, so I'm happy to follow up with the committee to provide that checklist and everything that the districts have to provide. I'm going to leave it at that. We will follow up with that exact list.
Thank you. Please continue.
Okay. This is just doing the math out for the intensive needs students and adding it back in. So we're still taking our adjusted ADM and moving it forward through this slide. In the beginning, you will have noticed that NOME was projecting a few correspondence students. We have been ignoring the correspondence students up to this point, so now we're going to bring them back into the calculation. Correspondence students receive a multiplied factor of 0.9. And once again, we have another slide that shows the math behind this. Taking our school size adjusted and adding back in the adjusted correspondence students that NOME had provided us. At this point, we have now come up with our adjusted ADM. And so at this point, we have reached the end of our growing this number of ADM that we counted at the beginning of the count or through the count period. We're going to multiply it by the base student allocation to come up with basic need. And this just shows the math and taking the AADM and multiplying it by the BSA to come up with basic need. This slide just gives you a little bit more of a just top-down mathematical look at how this all works out. So this might be a little easier to digest than 20 slides to get here.
And I'll just point out that obviously we're starting with a projected average daily membership of 715, but when you get to it through all of the adjustments, the district adjusted average daily membership increases to the 17.1. So it's like, it, just so you can see how the number changes through the formula.
Okay, at this point, we've come up with basic need, but we still haven't figured out who's going to pay for basic need. So at this point, we're going to start to figure out who is going to pay for basic need. So we have three elements in here, a required local contribution, federal impact aid, and state aid.
And can you provide just a little description of each one of these?
Sure. We will actually kind of cover some of this as we go through it. And so, let's see. If a local, required local effort, if you happen to be a first-class city or a first-class borough or home rule city, then by statute, you are a municipal school district. And so you are responsible for running your the school district within your geographic area. And so you have a local effort that you have to provide by statute. And so this is how we're going to figure out what your local effort is. We do have areas of the state that are called regional education attendance areas. They are referred to as unorganized areas of the state. They do not have a local contribution requirement, but we will go through how that varies when we get to the next stage beyond to the impact aid, basically. So we'll cover that when we get to impact aid. So at this point, we are going to take the full and true value of the real property in the city or borough, and we will multiply it by 2.65 mils, and that is going to be one of our calculations. We're going to have, I know I'm running out of time.
I think that's a different group that is reading this.
At this point, we're actually going to take two looks at the required local effort. So first off, we're going to take the true value and we're going to apply 2.65 mils to it. And then we'll also take a look at 45% of the prior year basic need. We will take the smaller of those two numbers, and that will become the municipality's required local contribution. So this just goes through and shows the calculation. In this case, Nome would have the 2.65s of the full and true value. Would become their basic need, would become their local contribution. At this point, we have federal impact aid payments. Federal impact aid payments are monies received by school districts for federal lands in their school district that are not subject to taxation. In most cases, for most of the impact aid received in the state, it's due to native lands, but we do have, the state does apply on behalf of the military bases. So there is impact aid funding that goes to Anchorage, Fairbanks, and Kodiak. Those are the three areas that have the three bases in Alaska that we apply for. We also apply for impact aid for Mount Edgecombe also. The impact aid that's received, we cannot take into consideration one-fifth of the native lands, any special education money that's coming through the impact aid. We cannot take that into consideration for funding of basic need and any construction funds. We have an example of what Nome received in eligible impact aid. This is the impact aid that would have already have had any SPED, the native lands, and any construction funds removed out of it. So this is the amount that we would have been able to take a look at.
Madam Chair.
President Stevens.
So impact aid is federal funds coming into our districts. Is it based on every per student? You count up the number of students from military, and that's how you come up with impact aid? Or
it, through the chair, President Stevens. It's based on, yes, the number of students that qualify that live upon those lands. So in this case, the military bases will take a look to see the number of students that are living on base, and then they will report those to us that we can then include on the application to the Department of Education. As far as school districts are concerned, they're going to identify any students that live on native lands, and they will have to prove that up for impact aid program. Then they actually submit those applications on their own, and that they receive that impact aid payment directly to the district. We get copies of what was sent to the district for the foundation purposes.
Thank you. So impact aid does not include students whose parents live in the community.
Through the chair, President Stevens, I do not believe they do. I believe it's only for those students that live on those property on those federal properties.
Thank you. Because they're paying property tax and
yes.
Thank you.
So, because Nome happens to be a first-class city, we are going to run a calculation to decide how much of that impact aid that we're even going to take a look at. So at this point, we have an eligible amount. We're going to figure out how much they're contributing locally to their education. So at this point, we're going to take a look and we're going to take the required local contribution and we're going to divide it by budgeted local contribution. And at this point, these are the items that we would take a look at for budgeted local contribution. We're going to take a look at any appropriations, any investment on earnings, any in-kind services, and any other local. And those are all categories that they would provide to us.
Just a quick question, particularly about this local contribution. I know in a report that I received from Ledger Search that something of this description has been around since 1966, the idea of local contribution since 1966. But there are folks who ask about what would it look like if we eliminated local contribution or reduced it substantially. What would that impact be, or what would that function? How would we do that, or would that be something we could do in statute?
Chair Tobin, certainly the legislature is free to do whatever they choose to do. Likelihood is, as we have gone through here, we're talking about impact aid and being able to use it as a funding component for basic need. We do have to go through and prove up that we are an equalized state through a process, through a disparity test. And that disparity test looks to make sure that we don't have a disparity that's greater than 25% after lopping off the top 5% and the bottom 5% of our data. So we take the 95th percentile and the 5th percentile, and we can't be more than 25% different between the two. At that point, then the impact aid program says you have maintained equalization. At that point, you can now utilize impact aid funding as a funding component in your state funding. If we were to fail that, then the department would not be, or the state would not be allowed to utilize that. Currently, there's about $75 million, sometimes has been as high as about $90 million that's been received in eligible impact aid that we have used to offset basic need or basically offset state aid. If we did not have that, the legislature would have to come up with perhaps another $75 million to provide in state aid to school districts because we would not be able to look at it. Moving on, in this case, it's another math problem. So we have their required local contribution. We have their budgeted local. The two numbers provide us a percentage. What we will then do is we will take the eligible impact aid. We will apply that percentage because they happen to be a municipal school district at this point. And then we always apply take 90% of what's left to pay for part of basic need. This is where things get a little bit different with the REAAs. The REAAs, it's the eligible amount times that 90%. So even though they don't have a local contribution, we utilize more of their impact aid to fund basic need than we do with the municipal school districts. So that's where we have kind of the offset for the local contribution with the REAs. And here we're getting real close to the end. We have state aid. We came up with our basic need number. We've taken out the required local. We've taken out impact aid. We've now come up with state aid. So this is what NOME would, the formula says the state would pay NOME for their education in fiscal year 2024, if this all plays out the way they projected. Okay, if you happen to be one of those municipal school districts, you can also provide additional local contribution. And we also provide a quality schools grant that goes out to all districts. And we will go over those two elements and then we will be done with this. So in this case, for an additional local contribution, what we will take a look at is we will do two calculations once again. We will take we will look at 2 mils of the full and true value tax base. And then we will also run a calculation to look at 23% of current year basic need. And we will take the larger of those two numbers. That larger number then becomes the additional amount that the district or the local community can contribute towards education at this point. In this case, this slide's just showing you that they had the required local. They had an additional amount. The maximum local contribution they can provide is at almost 3.7 million on these projections. The reason we cap the local contribution, the additional amount, also goes back to being an equalized state and controlling the amount of additional resources to keep us equalized. Quality Schools Grant. Quality Schools Grant.
Before you go on, let's see. So looking at NOAM, so this indicates that they have, there's a minimum amount they've had to contribute to the school district, but they have also contributed the maximum amount. Is that true?
In this case, this is just showing us what they can contribute. As I recall, if I go back.
They can't contribute 2.360.
Oh, did I go too far?
So through the chair, President Stevens, so the required local is what they are required to do. The additional is what they can do. So they can contribute up to a maximum of the 3.7 million in fiscal year 2024. So this is based on their projected numbers. Obviously we don't know in 2024 yet because we're not there exactly what they did. We can provide the committee with a chart of what districts have contributed in the current fiscal year versus they're required to additionals for the maximum if that's a benefit to the committee.
Madam Chair, I think it'd be very good to know who's contributed to the max and who's not quite doing that. It'd be good to know that.
Certainly.
So I apologize. I'm going to ask you to try to summarize your last four slides here as we are over the top of the hour. That clock is wrong.
Yes.
Oh, that's right. It is.
I think really the last key thing is this Quality Schools Grant. It's just taking the adjusted ADM that we came up with in prior slides, multiplying it by $16. They have to submit an application for it. Once they've submitted that application explaining what they're going to use it for, we cut them that dollar amount. In this case, this is NOAM's amount. We also now show what the state entitlement is with state aid and the quality schools here. There is also a provision in statute saying that if the legislature were to provide insufficient funding to fund the program fully, we would prorate based on basic need. This is just a kind of a linear look statewide of how the numbers flow out through the formula. So these would be totals out to the state aid entitlement of almost 1.2 billion. And these are who you should talk to.
Well, thank you so very much for this very illuminative presentation. Are there any last questions from committee members before we end today? Seeing none, I want to thank you both again for walking us through this. I am sure questions will come up, and we will continue to ask additional input as we work out the next steps. This concludes our agenda for today. The next meeting will be Wednesday, March 8th, where we will hear presentations from, again, the Department of Education and Early Development, the University of Alaska, and the Institute of Social and Economic Research about teacher retention and recruitment. We'll also receive a presentation from Alexi Painter on Friday, we will receive a presentation from Alexi Painter on the history of the foundation formula. As I see there's no other business today, I'm going to conclude today's Senate Education at 5:08 p.m.